right. I started to see a series in Hebrews a long time ago, slowly working through it. I preached it a little bit on, started on Hebrews 11 while we were in separate groups. So some heard the introduction to that or opening first few chapters of Hebrews 11. And I kind of stopped there. It's been a long time. I think it might have been April, May. I don't remember. Long time ago, where I stopped. And I've been thinking of Hebrews 11 a lot in a different light, and what is it, and why all these different people. And I've preached on Hebrews 11 itself without the series a few times. And so I've kind of stopped there, and I do plan to continue. And in a way, what I shared, I think it was last time I was here, I forget between Arburg and here, but I think it was eyes to see, if you remember that theme of seeing reality, walking in reality. So this is a continuation of that, and eyes to see came out of looking at Hebrews 11. And this is, again, this may be another introduction to Hebrews 11. I'm not going to go there to Hebrews 11 today, but it looks at what they looked at, what Hebrews 11, those men, as they walked through their life, why? Why did they do what they did? And my message today, again, a similar in theme to last one, but a different angle, but very similar, same theme. And what I titled today is, what is truth? Very simple, what is truth? And what I want to do is not give the answer in a sentence and say, there it is, we could, in a way, but I'll be putting a puzzle piece up here, then fitting one there, and then next one over here, and at the end, hopefully it's open. There's nothing hidden, I just want to look at it from different angles. So I really appreciate the opening, James, Book of John. I think has become, that and Matthew, my favorites for what's in there, especially John 8 to 14, 15. There's tremendous life-altering content in there. And I'll be reading from John 18 in a bit. Maybe turn there. John 18, but I just want to make a few comments before we do that, and before that, let's pray. God, we commit this morning in your care. You are our God, you are our Father, and we are your children, the sheep of your pasture. Sheep can be very easily distracted and led astray, and we are definitely that. So we ask that you would give us clarity, God, of life, clarity of heart, and clarity of mind, as you are truth, you are life, and you are the way, and we want to be firmly walking in that, so we don't get shocked when we come to heaven's door and realize how far off we've been. God, keep us true, that we can seamlessly come home and not be bewildered or disappointed or let down in things that we've picked up here on earth that took us from our true course, but that we walk truly with you and humbly with you, just like you did on this earth in your humanity, that you walked as a God, and we as humans would want to be God-like in all that we do. May this message be clear to everybody, including myself. Give me clarity to speak your pure truth without muddying anything, to look at you and who you are, and even the concept of truth, God, that can be clouded. I pray that you would do that for us. We commit this next hour or so and our life, of course, in your hands. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so what is truth? It's sometimes, I've had the impression in the past that truth can be hurt by deception. I think I said last time in my message that truth in wartime, Winston Churchill said, truth is so important that it should always be guarded by a bodyguard of lies. You know that statement from last time? So depending how you unpack that, but truth is actually not hurt by lies or deception. So truth itself is not hurt by lies or deception. But what happens is people interacting with that situation are hurt by the lies and deception. But the truth itself is not. How things are is how they are. If somebody is a beautiful person and he's slandered by 10 people, in the eyes of 1,000 people that those people talk to, this one person can be viewed by 1,000 people as being a bad person. And those 10 people think so, and 1,000 people think so, but it does not change anything about who he is. Nothing. He is, in the sight of God, a good person. So no matter what's being told, no matter what the perception is, truth is not hurt, truth is not moved, truth is not under attack. Truth just is, it's not movable. And truth and fact are parallel, but they're different things. I'm not sure I want to get into that. But keep that in mind. The truth is, and it's not hurt by lies. Anybody interacting with the situation is hurt by the deception and lies. And interestingly enough, Jesus calls, in a passage that we'll read in a bit, he calls the devil the father of lies. So his main job on this planet, in your life, in your heart, in this church, would be deception and lies and getting you just off track. And his point is to get us really off track, but we are committed to God, and we're probably not going to do anything dramatic and very evil. But if he can get us off track in any way, that's a check for him. So he's always going to be wanting to do that. That's his nature. That's who he is. That's his tactic. And Jesus Christ, on the other hand, wants to define and clarify truth. Here is where things are. And as we I sometimes give a bit of a softer introduction or more gentle, but in this case we'll go to the crucifixion scene, the trial of Jesus. But again, as we go through this whole message here, keep this in mind. The truth is not hurt by lies or deception. The people are. Truth is unchallenged and unchanged. It doesn't move. It's not threatened. It just is. But those looking at it can have very, very, very bad consequences if they believe the lie and go that way. So, and just another quick example. So when God created the heavens and earth, and that is when he created a whale. And at school, I saw a woodpecker on Friday, pecking, peck, peck, then looking around and peck, peck. And he made a walrus and a wren. If you think of those different things, God made those things. He designed them. If you go from a whale to a wren or a woodpecker, they're very, very, very different creatures. There's tremendous scope for creativity, imagination, grandness in that. And God made them. And what people think about that, what all the universities think about that, what the secular textbooks and schools and philosophy teachers think about that, doesn't matter anything as far as the fact goes. But it matters a lot with how it plays out on this planet and how people live their life and how politics are run and how businesses are run and what children are being taught. And eternity matters. But the fact still remains, the truth is that God created the heavens and the earth. That just is. So the truth is unchanged, no matter what the entire planet thinks about it. But they're all deviating with very, very serious consequences. But it does not change the truth. And does it hurt? Does the lie hurt the ones that believe the lie? Absolutely, with dramatic and severe consequences. Hence the devil's tool of deception. So another quick comment is, all questions of ethics and morality, if you think of the current U.S. elections, if you follow that at all, there's an election coming up in 10 days or so. And the two parties are, the two camps, I'll say, are very, very, very divided. U.S. politics has always been messy. They've always been divisive, some years more than others, but this one is a really bad one. And there's been some severe ones in the past, starting back to when they first had elections to the parties. But this one is very, very divided. And these people are saying this, and these people are saying that. And they're very polarized. So there's different questions of ethics and morality and right and social programs, or even in our country. But you can weave this way and think they have a point here. But at the end of the day, it's kind of all the same thing. And I'd like to look at that later again. So all questions of ethics and morality go back to this question: is there a God as represented in the Bible? And if there is, it actually wipes off so many things. That if you answer that question, it actually doesn't matter if it's this way or this way, because they're both in a way not really relevant. They are to some degree, but not really. I'll give you a different perspective. The question, should we vote? It came up a while back in a brother's discussion. And on an online, somebody asked as well on a WhatsApp status, should you vote? So there's some people are clear on it. There's a bit of gray in there. What about the social issue? This party is better than this one for us, even here. Should we vote? I'll say it this way. Let's imagine you were living in Japan, and they have elections. Because you've lived there for 20 years, you're allowed to vote in those elections. However, the party that is going to be in has said they're going to declare war on Canada, which you never rescinded your citizenship. So you're allowed to vote in Japan, but you're a citizen of Canada. You're still technically live here. Would you vote for a party in Japan that would be attacking Canada in the next coming year? That's part of their program. Well, I'm not really Japanese, and we all see where the illustration's going, but as living in Japan, I wouldn't want to be voting for anyone that would be attacking Canada, because that's really where I'm from. So if I value Canada, I'm not going to vote, even though I agree with a lot of their program. One of their agendas is attack on Canada. So conscientiously, though I live in Japan, though I like a lot of what's going on, I'm not going to vote for a party that's going to attack Canada. Just, I can't do that. So whether you should vote or not, let's flip it. If there is a political party that you vote for, I support party A, and you're on this earth, and it matters because they have a better social program than this side. But if you see things in a certain way, whether you cast that ballot or not, it'll depend how you view your citizenship first, very, very, very much. And I'll maybe touch on that at the end. So there's questions that though they're questions, in a different light, it becomes a non-issue. And I'm not sure if I'm being clear with that, but again, I'll touch on it later. I just want to introduce some of those things. So John 18, let's switch gears a little bit here and go to John 18. Starting in 12, for sake of time, I'll be reading a lot, but I want to cut out some things. So starting in 12, 18, 12, then the band and the captain and officers of the Jews took Jesus and bound him and led him away to Annas first. He was the father-in-law to Caiaphas, which was the high priest of the same year. Now Caiaphas was he which gave counsel to the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. And Simon Peter followed Jesus and did so, and another disciple that was known to the high priest. I'm going to skip forward to verse 19 and skip to Peter's account. Then the high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and his doctrine. So now he's before the religious leaders of the day. He's not in a civil court. He's in a religious court. Keep that in mind. And the high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine. And Jesus answered him. Okay, they asked him, what do you believe? Okay, let's set things straight here. What do you believe? And Jesus answered him, said, I spake openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogues. Always I was there. And in the temple, whither the Jews always resort. And in secret have I said nothing. In other words, what's this about? I've always been very clear what I believe. I always taught in public, every day, where the Jews gathered. I was there. I've been talking the same thing. What's really the question here? Why askest thou me? Ask them which heard me. What I have said unto them. Behold, they know what I said. There's no secrets. And when he had thus spoken, one of the officers which stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, Answerest thou the high priest so? And Jesus answered him, If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why smitest thou me? What's wrong with the answer I gave? I just said I've always been consistent with my message. He's not defending. He's just bringing truth to the situation. That's what I want to bring out here. He's constantly clarifying and defining and bringing truth to bear. When it's being muddied, he's clarifying. And again, I'm touching on a few different things just to bring this and this and this. So if it feels scattered, I believe it'll come. Hope it'll come together in the end. So what he's doing is Jesus is not debating. He's not giving an answer for an answer back and forth like a debate. He's bringing truth to the situation. And that's key here. That's what I want to bring out. He's bringing truth to the situation. He's trying to recalibrate their view, their focus. He asked, when they asked him, what are you teaching? Probably an antagonistic tone, in an offensive tone. He simply said, is this about what I'm teaching? Or is this about something else? He's just clarifying. He said, if you really want to know what I'm teaching, it's always been out there. What's this about? Why do you ask this here? What are you really asking? And that's a fair question. And then when he said that, this struck him. And in answer to that, he simply said, did I lie? Was it a bad answer? If it was a bad answer, tell me. If not, why am I struck? He's simply clarifying. He's not debating with them. And now Annas had sent him bound unto Caiaphas the high priest. And we'll skip forward. We'll skip Peter's denial again. Then Pilate went out unto them. Oh, they brought him to Pilate. They led Jesus, in verse 28, they led the Jesus from Caiaphas into the hall of judgment, and was early, and they themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled, that they might eat the Passover. So this all happened in the night and early morning. Pilate then went out unto them and said, what accusation bring against this man? So Pilate is introduced, and he's wondering, what's this about? First thing in the morning, I'm woken up, here's a mob with a man. What's going on? So the civil court now steps in and is wondering, what's the charge? Did he kill his mother? Did he break a wall down of your temple? What's he doing? What's going on? What accusation bring you against this man? And they said unto him, if he were not a malefactor, breaker of the law, we would have not delivered him up to this. He still doesn't have a charge. They said, if he were not a malefactor, we would not have brought him. Pilate has still no idea what's going on. That is not an answer. Then said Pilate unto them, take him and judge him according to your law. So they said, he's obviously a lawbreaker. He said, deal with him then. I mean, if he didn't kill anybody, or like, if there's nothing for me to do, what's your point here? What's going on? The Jews therefore said unto him, it's not lawful for us to put any man to death. So there's no charge yet. But they were really, really upset about him. And now it's coming. Pilate says, I don't know what he did, but they're wanting him dead. Something just opened up. Something really big is going on here. That's not a normal way of doing things. That the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spake, signifying what death he should die. Then Pilate entered into the judgment hall again and called Jesus and said unto him, art thou the king of the Jews? And Jesus answered him. Again, look at this clarification here. Sayest thou this thing of yourself? Do you really want to know, or is it others that are saying it? Getting Pilate to think about what he's saying. And Pilate answered, am I a Jew? Thine own nation and thy chief priests have delivered thee unto me. What hast thou done? So I believe he's genuinely trying to figure out what's going on here. And Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from thence. So he's truthfully answering in as clear and concise and honest and open way. The statement that Jesus said was absolutely crystal clear in the light of reality, in the light of how things actually were. And that was his answer. Absolute, crystal clear truth. Not muddied. If Pilate would have taken that and said, whoa, what are you talking about? That doesn't even make sense. Help me. I think Jesus would have given him a lot more. But he heard it, it went over his head, and he dismissed it. He wasn't really interested in it. And Pilate therefore said unto him, art thou a king then? And Jesus answered, thou sayest I'm a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. And everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. Think of that statement. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. And Pilate said unto him, what is truth? And when he had said this, he went out again unto the Jews, and said unto them, I find no fault to him at all. So again, there's still no charge. As far as we know from this passage, there's still no charge that he's a murderer, that he's a thief, that he attacked the legion. There's nothing like that yet. What he knows is they want him dead. Jesus gave him, according to his viewpoint, cryptic answers, but he still doesn't really know what's going on. Then he says, you have a custom that I should release unto you under the Passover. Should I release Barabbas? And they yelled, Barabbas. Then Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him. So the response from Pilate after his interaction with Jesus, and Jesus' crystal clear answers as far as reality goes, Pilate went and scourged him. And we watched a video with the youth here about from Nabil Qureshi. He goes through some of the crucifixion scene. It was a horrible, if you've ever read about human or Roman scourging, it was a leather whip with a few different leather sections on it with bones embedded in it. And as they would have beaten him, It wrapped around, grabbed, and ripped flesh out. It was absolutely horrific. The scourging was not a strap that you got beaten with or whipped with. It was way, 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 way more than that. It was more than welts, more than just hurting. It literally grabbed and ripped. It was an awful thing. And they would say that many people often didn't even survive the scourging. That was often a precursor to crucifixion. They didn't survive the scourging and didn't need to be crucified. It was that rough. And the soldiers plaited a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe, and said, "Hail, King of the Jews," and they smote him with their hands. And Pilate went forth and again said unto them, "Behold, I bring him forth to you that you may know that I find no fault in him." He keeps saying that. Then came Jesus forth wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said unto them, "Behold a man." So they saw that. They saw that he was severely injured. The robe, purple, the crown. He's on the balcony, he's looking down. He brings him out, presents. When the chief priests, therefore, and officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him, crucify him." Basically finishing off. So they said earlier, a chapter before, it is not lawful for us to put any man to death. And they're halfway there, and they're wanting it finished. And then Pilate says, "Take you him and crucify him. I find no fault in him." He's now handing authority to them. Do what you want. Then the Jews answered him, "We have a law, and by our law he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God." So now Pilate actually gets a charge. And I think this maybe rings something in his head. And when Pilate therefore heard that, he was more afraid. So now the ruler of the whole area is afraid. Something clicked. And he went again into the judgment hall and saith unto Jesus, "Whence art thou? Where are you from?" Basically. And Jesus gave him no answer. Which is a very interesting response. We could have maybe had an earthquake or anything miraculous, and bang, just a proving, okay, I am who I am. Would you only know, Pilate? There's many things that could have happened there. Jesus defending, even saying, okay, I am God, I'll prove it to you, but to show you that I'm control, I'm going to go along with it. He could have taken that tactic. There's a few things that could have happened, but it didn't. It was so fast, so chaotic, so without reason or sense that it just kind of bumped from one situation to another. But Jesus at this point just chooses to leave it. No defense, no arguing, no justification, no if you only knew, none of that. He gave no answer. Then said Pilate unto him, "Speakest thou none unto me? Knowest thou that I have the power to crucify thee and the power to release thee?" So he's trying to put pressure on him. And Jesus answered, "Thou couldst have no power at all against me except it were given thee from above. Therefore, he that delivereth me unto thee hath the greater sin." So he's saying, you have authority because you were given authority. You're simply in a place. You were given it. You're a tool. But those that are using you, we'll get to that in a second here in the other next passage. Those that are using you have the greater sin. You're just a pawn, basically, is what Jesus told him. And really, he was. He was. He was simply a tool. I'll be reading something in a minute that clarifies that. And that was absolutely crystal clear truth. It was as clear as that situation could be made. He didn't muddy anything. Jesus gave him absolute clear truth. And from thenceforth, Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, saying, "If thou let this man go, thou art not Caesar's friend." And then Pilate got basically scared. And at the end, they delivered him, took him out to be crucified. I'm going to leave that section there, move to the next. So what just happened there? There's so much in there, a bumpy, chaotic trial. I have something I want to read from my phone here. Bear with me. Rabbi Zacharias has in one of his talks, he has an imaginary story where Pilate talks to Gaius. Has anyone heard Rabbi Sarah read that? Who's heard that? It's fascinating. It's a paraphrase of what we just read. So give me 5 minutes. Let's read that. I'll try to be quick. but just it sheds a slightly different light on what happened here, paraphrase. So let's go there. So Pilate, after this all happened, maybe a month after, is talking to his friend Gaius in the courts. So it's a conversation in an evening, for example. It suddenly closed in on me, Gaius. Excuse me. The impact of how trapped I was. The proud arm of Rome, with all its boast of justice, was to be but a dirty dagger in the pudgy hands of the priest. Think of that statement. Exactly true. The proud arm of Rome, with all its boast of justice, was justice done here? This was a Roman event. This was a Roman court. And they were known for their justice. But the proud arm of Rome, with all its boast of justice, was to be but a dirty dagger in the pudgy hands of the priest. Exactly what Jesus said. I was waiting in the room, Gaius, the one I used for court, officially enthroned with cloak and guard, when they let this Jesus in. Well, Gaius, don't smile at this, but if you value your jaw, but I have had no peace since the day he walked into my judgment hall. It's been years, but these scenes I read from the back of my eyelids every night. You've seen Caesar, haven't you, when he was young and strapping, inspecting the legion? His arrogant manner was childlike compared to that of the Nazarene. He didn't have to strut, you see. He walked towards my throne, arms bound, but with a strident mastery and control that by its very audacity silenced the room for an instant and left me trembling with an insane desire to stand up and salute. The clerk began reading the absurd list of charges, the priestly delegation punctuating these with palm rubbings, beard strokings, eye rollings, and the pious gutturals I had so long since learned to ignore. But I more felt the Gaius than heard it. I questioned him mechanically. He answered very little. But what he said, and the way he said it, was as if his level gaze had pulled my naked soul right up into his eyes and was probing it there. It seemed like the man wasn't even listening to the charges brought against him, as a voice deep within me to say, "You're the one on trial, Pilate." You would have sworn, Gaius, that he had just come out of a friendly interest to see what was going to happen to me. The very pressure of him standing there had grown unbearable when a slave rushed in, all terrible, interrupting court to bring a message from Claudia. She stabbed him the stylus in that childish way that she does when she's distraught. "Don't judge this amazing man, Pilate," she wrote. I was haunted in dreams of him this night. Gaius, I tried to free him. From that moment on, I tried. And I always think he knew it. I think he was a Galilean, so I delivered him out of my jurisdiction. But the native King Herod discovered he was born in Judea and sent him right back to me. I appealed to the crowd that had gathered in the streets, hoping they were his sympathizers. But Caiaphas had stationed agitators to whip up the beast, the cry for blood. And you know how any citizen is here, that just after breakfast he loves to cry for the blood of another. I had him beaten, Gaius, a thorough barracks room beating. I'm still not sure why. To appease the crowd, I guess. But do we Romans really need reasons for beating? Isn't that the code for anything we don't understand? Well, it didn't work, Gaius. The crowd roared like some slavering beast when I brought him back. If only you could have watched him. They had thrown some rags of purple over his pulped and bleeding shoulders. They jammed a chaplet of thorns down on his forehead. And it fit. It all fit. He stood there watching them from the balcony, lame from weakness by now, but royal, I tell you. Not just pain, but pity shining from his eyes. And I kept thinking, somehow this is monstrous. This is all upside down. The purple is real. The crown is real. And somehow these animal noises, the crowd is shrieking, should be shouts of praise. Then Caiaphas played his master stroke on me, announcing there in public that Jesus claimed a crown. And this was treason to Caesar. And then the guards began to glance at each other, and the mob began to shout, "Hail Caesar, Hail Caesar." I knew I was beaten, and that's when I gave the order. I couldn't look at him, Gaius. And then I did a childish thing. I called for water there on the balcony. I washed my hands of that whole wretched affair, but as they led him away, I did look up, and he turned and looked at me. No smile, no pity. He just glanced at my hands, and I felt the weight of his eyes on them. Ever since. But you're yawning, Gaius. I've kept you up. And the fact of the matter is, you're in need of some sleep now and some holidays. Yes, sleep. Claudia will be asleep by now. Rows of lighted lamps line her couch. She can't sleep in the dark anymore. Not since that afternoon, you see. Since the afternoon when the sun went out and my guards executed him. That's what I said. I don't know how or what or why. I only know that I was there and thought at middle of the day it turned as black as the tunnels of hell in that miserable city. Well, I tried to compose Claudia and explain how I'd been trapped, and she railed at me with her dream. She has had that dream ever since when she sleeps in the dark. that there was to be a new Caesar and that I had killed him. O Gaius, we've been to Egypt to their seers and magicians. We've listened by the hour to the oracles of the musty temples of Greece, chattering their inanities. We've called it an oriental curse that we're under, and we've tried to break it 1,000 ways, but there's no breaking it. Do you know why I've kept going, Gaius? Deep within the curse is the haunting, driving certainty that he's still somewhere near, and that I still have some unfinished business with him, and that now and then as I walk by the lake, he's following me. And as much as this strikes terror, I wonder if that isn't the only hope. You see, guys, if I could walk up to him this time and salute him, tell him that I now know that whoever else he was the only man worthy of his name in Judea that day. He's referring to King. Tell him that I know I was entrapped, that I trapped myself. Tell him there was one Roman that wishes he were Caesar. I believe that would do it, wouldn't it, Gaius? I believe he would listen and know that I meant it. And at last I would see him smile. It's quiet tonight, isn't it, Gaius? Not a breeze stirring by the lake. Yes, good night. You'd better run along. Would you please waken the slave outside the door and tell him to bring me a cloak, my heavy one, please. I believe I will walk by the lake. It's dark there, Gaius. But I won't be alone. I guess I've really not been alone, not since that day. Yes, good night, Gaius. So that is, I believe, a clear paraphrase of what happened. And Jesus knew it. And the answers he gave were just like that. They were sharp, clear, distinct. He said exactly how the situation was. To continue, going to John 8, just for another aspect, John 8, turn back a bit. And again, the question is, what's going on here? So John 8, starting in, give me a second here. So it's the passage where the woman is taken in adultery. His response to that, he sets it right. He clarifies the situation. Then he says in verse 12, just for sake of time, I need to skip. I was going to read it. Then spake Jesus again unto them, saying, I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. The Pharisees therefore saying unto him, thou bearest record of thyself, and that record is not true. You're saying something about you, and that's not right. Then Jesus answered and said unto them, though I bear record of myself, yet my record is true. Think of Jesus' language here. For I know whence I came and whither I go, but you cannot tell whence I came and whither I go. You judge after the flesh. You see what you see, he's telling them. I judge no man. Yet if I judge, my judgment is true. I am not alone. I am the Father that sent me. It is written in your law that the testimony of two men is true. And I am one that bear witness of myself, and the Father that sent me beareth witness of me. Then they said unto him, as James said here before, where is thy father? And this could be, I think very likely it was a slur on him, as in it was known that he was conceived before they were married. And I think this was a hit on him. They were trying to insult, where is thy father? And Jesus answered, you neither know me nor my father. If you had known me, you would have known my father also. Then skipping forward a bit, they interact a bit more in verse 31. Then said Jesus to those Jews which believed on him. The whole context of chapter 8 is antagonism. They poke at him. They try to trick him. They ask him loaded questions that he's supposed to stumble over. And then Jesus here in these two verses, in that whole chapter, these two verses are alone. Then said Jesus to those Jews which believed on him, if you continue in my word, then are you my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. That is a tremendous statement. So as he's interacting in this whole long, the whole chapter, I believe. Yeah, the whole chapter from start to finish, all four 59 verses are antagonistic interactions back and forth. They're after him. And in these two, 31 and 32 here, Jesus turned. Then Jesus said to those Jews which believed on him, he turns and speaks to them. this little pocket here and says, if you continue in my word, believe me, then you are my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. So in the 57 other verses, the back and forth, the challenging, they were not interested in truth. They wanted to trap him. They wanted their own way. They were not after truth. But Jesus said, if you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. So that's also a very interesting account. And if you look at it, what's going on there as well, in light of the other one we read, with the trial and this one, what's really going on? Have you ever seen, I think I mentioned this before, but I don't know if you ever gone into your pantry and found your three-year-old in there, and they hear you coming, you open the door, and they do this. Has anyone ever experienced that? I have. It's, you want to bite them at that point. But I've had it happen. You walk in the pantry and somebody goes like this. As you look at that, in their mind, from whatever they can see, that's a good situation because I hear daddy coming. I've got the cookie or the chips or the chocolate chips or the whatever. I've got it. I need out. There's the door. He's going to walk in the door. What do I do? Well, hide. Okay, now he can't see me. And their viewpoint as a three-year-old, it's actually logical, but it's not reality. See, daddy comes along and taps him on the top of the head and says, hello, I see you. What are you doing? Nothing. So to them, they see what they see. It's somewhat logical, but you have to go with the other perspective, the bigger one, the one that's more real, the one that puts a different light on the other one. And to some degree, as light as that illustration is, it's actually what's happening here. And like I said before, this is not a debate. Jesus is not trading argument for argument. That's not what's happening. If you look at really what he's doing, Jesus is simply, when needed and when they're being listened to, or when he's being listened to, he offers clarity and truth. If you would almost look at it like on a platter, and you're looking at something of substance, he's giving them that, and they're not interested in it. So he, in a sense, almost takes it back, and he answers them, yes. But it's not a debate. He's bringing truth to the situation, bringing reality to the situation. In a way, he's trying to tap them on the head and saying, I can see you. So he's not saying to the three-year-old, well, whatever, I'll just leave that there. He's basically saying, I can see you. You don't need to cover. He's trying to open their eyes. You are not in reality. I am. That's what he's trying to communicate to them. So it's not the better answer wins here. That's not what's happening. Jesus is seeing things clearly, exactly for how it is. And he was trying to get the Pharisees and the teachers of the law to see things in reality. It was what he was trying to do, exactly how it is. He was trying to bring them to truth. David Berceau, in his book, has a story about Andy Dimwit playing Monopoly. Who has read that book? I'm using some familiar illustrations, so if some of you know them, good. If not, okay. So anyways, and David Berceau talks of an illustration there with Andy Dimwit playing Monopoly. It's a good book, Secrets of the Kingdom Life. He has a CD on it as well. But he gives a situation where Andy Dimwit is maybe 14 and loves to play Monopoly summer holidays. It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and Andy and his four friends or whatever are playing Monopoly in the house, and Andy's father, who's a real estate agent, comes in as they start the game and says, hey Andy, my boss said there's a house 2 blocks over. He wants the lawn mowed today. There's a very real potential of a sale, but that yard is really messy. Andy, you'll take the mower and the trimmer, go down the block and a half and mow it. And the appointment's from between 4 and 5. So Andy, make sure it's done. He's paying you $100. Like, this is important. I mean, that's a lot of wage for a 20-minute job, but do it right, Andy. Like, it's $100. That today's your day. Andy nods and yeah, okay, 4 to 5. Yeah, okay. So they get into Monopoly, starting at 1 o'clock. They go to 2. By then the game gets going. 3 o'clock, and Andy's looking at the clock. It's getting to 4. Takes 20 minutes, I can do it yet. And his friends are like, Andy, come on. You've got Park Place, Boardwalk. We have a few strong ones, but it can go either way this time. Let's focus on the game here. So they do another round or two. Somebody lands on Boardwalk. It's like, whoa, he cashes in, and the game starts swinging this way. But the time is going, and Andy's looking at it. I can still do it. It'll take so and so long. And okay. But then as they play again, there's another round, and somebody else lands on Park Place, and it's like he's massively cashing in, and he's going to win like he's not won before. And then at 10 to 4, which he pushed it off as long as he could because Dad said it was from 4 to 5, he might be 50 minutes late, I can easily do it. At 10 to 4, he's about ready to get up, and his dad comes in the door very upset and sees the game and sees Andy on his tummy. Andy, what are you doing? I just lost the sale. They came to the house, they saw the yard, it looked dumpy, they drove off, and I think they would have taken it. What are you doing? And Andy's like, And his friends are like, what's the problem? You won. You cashed in like never before. This was your absolute, you creamed us. This is like, you got it. You got like $6,000. And as you look at that and his friends, I think there's times when we are the friends and Andy is riding the fence. There's times I think when we're like that. So situation one, Andy could have been happy with his $6,000 of paper money. Or at 2 o'clock, he would have said, I got to get this thing done. See ya. This is, it's good. I might win. I probably would win, in fact, but I got to go. And he goes and he mows the lawn, does it well, does it right, collects a $100 bill. And he has a $100 bill, not $6,000. But if you trade them, what's this versus that? That's ridiculous. But to his friends, in that viewpoint, you're giving up an absolute steal of a game and you're doing something else. So who cares? So there's two situations how you can look at that thing. And if we flip it again, the point is this. If you're not operating in reality, then you're in deception. Very simple. So is Monopoly real? The game? Yeah, Monopoly is kind of real. It's a game. You do play, you do win money. Is the money real? Kind of. Yeah, sort of. But there's a different reality that needs to supersede that. And if you're in the one, you're probably not looking at the other two clearly. If you're in this one, then this one has its proper perspective. This is the point here. So let's go back to the voting analogy, if I can do that. If you think, again, you're a citizen of Japan, and you're a citizen of Japan, you've been there for 20 years, again, you have the opportunity to vote. You're voting for a party that would declare war on Canada. Would you do that or would you not do it? Personally, in a secular sense, I would not do it because I don't want Canada attacked. My people are there. I like them. I like Tim Hortons. I like the winter. I don't want Japan taken over. Let's protect them. I'll just not vote here. It's not going to do much, but I'm for sure not. They still probably will win, but at least my vote won't be with them. So if you take that scenario, put it to another way, if it's a reality that Jesus' kingdom is here and alive and real, and you're voting for somebody that would bomb your country or go against things that Jesus flatly talked about, can you do that? Like if, let's say, somebody has 50 good points, but they believe in going to war and killing innocents, or they would fund abortion. If it violates something that Jesus talked about, can you put your vote there and say, I support so-and-so? Well, could you realistically support a government that would, from Japan, bomb your country here? It depends how seriously you take that. So it depends how serious the kingdom of God is to you, if you're able to violate it or not. So if the kingdom of God, if your lawnmower job is real enough, then you can probably cancel a monopoly. It's not a problem. If they're 50-50, then you can toss answers of the merits, pros and cons. If you're in the monopoly world, you absolutely want to cast your vote. Can I say it that way? But if you're in the real world, where Jesus was and is, then to do something that violates God's kingdom, in my opinion, from what I can see it, and I'm open to be talked about this, is a flat cannot be done. Unless you are willing to step in and out of the real world. So again, is the monopoly real? Yes. Is the money real? Yes. Is there a game? Yes. But there's another reality here that just overlooks that so much that it just basically cancels the other one. So if you look at the life and example of Jesus and what he did and what he said, there were people around there looking at everything he was, but they didn't see it. But he did. And he was constantly, in all of his interactions that I looked at, he was constantly bringing truth and clarity and sharpness to the situation. So what's the play money and what's the real money? Jesus calls us to truth. So again, in John 19, I'll try to wrap up here in a minute or a few minutes. So in John 19, again, when we look at how they scourged him and the crucifixion scene, they saw what they saw, and I appreciate the picture James held up. He would have been dark-skinned. He would have had really dark hair, probably a beard, for sure brown eyes, not blonde, white-skinned, and blue-eyed. That's ridiculous, with flowing hair to the shoulders and a blue robe and white. That's silly, actually. So he would have been a normal Jewish person on trial. Pilate didn't know him, would have heard about him maybe, but that's how it looked, a normal Jewish person on trial. They were mad at him, and Pilate just kind of gave in from what we read. But how it was when Pilate, in the analogy or in the story I read, what he got glimpses of how it actually was. And Jesus was trying to tell him that. And had he been able to step into Jesus' world, it would have been very different. But how it looked and how it was were very, very different things. Whatever Jesus said in his exchanges, if you take them out, they're true forever. Whatever he said, whenever Jesus told Pilate, those things are true forever, absolutely unchanged, crystal clear, unchangeable. And Jesus offered those to him. He offered him the absolute truth. But yet there was no defense when there was no truth wanted. Jesus didn't need to defend or explain or massive miracles. He didn't do that. Truth is for those that want it, no problem. It's right there. But if you don't want it, if you are okay with being in a lie, that's your prerogative. A while back, a few years ago, a boxer that was famous a long time ago, he grew old and he was about 80 years old, and somebody mugged him on the street, or tried to. And this 80-year-old ex-boxer absolutely creamed this guy, the mugger. And people were, he did not know what he did. He sure learned his lesson. Going up to an 80-year-old man trying to rob him, and this guy absolutely cleaned his clock. So the boxer, what if the boxer had a different a different mindset, and the boxer had handed over his wallet, right? So he's 80 years old, this guy is 25. What he did was he knocked him out very efficiently, but what if he had handed over his wallet? So inside, he has all the ability to hit him and knock him out, like within 2 seconds. That's his ability inside. He's a professional boxer, even though he's 80 years old. But he would hand over his wallet. What does that do to the truth of anything? So the boxer proved it and hit him and kept his wallet. And he proved that I'm 80, but you're 25, but I'm on top of things. But if he handed his wallet and didn't show any of that power or position, and the man just would have thought he robbed an 80-year-old banker or something, or some normal 80-year-old, let's say it that way. What's the point of the boxer being able to box and being able to knock him out if he doesn't show it or if it's no use to him? Like, what if he had taken situation two? So the point of the illustration is, if something's there and you're not defending it, what's the rationale or the point? I'll say it a different way. If it needs to be proven on a pride or simply human level, maybe it's not worth the fuss. Maybe it's not worth the effort. What's the point of being the best boxer on the planet, even at 80, and being able to knock him out and just giving the wallet and having that information go unshown? So on one hand, it's actually worth nothing, that information. And on the other hand, if it's true, then God knows about it. And that's what counts, and that's where we want to be. So let's shift gears a bit and talk about reputation. So nobody wants a bad testimony, especially as churches, God's people, we don't want a bad reputation. But the key is this: what matters is what's true, what's inside. So character is who you are when no one is looking. And we can be motivated by truth and reality, or we need to be motivated by truth and reality, not by reputation or our environment. And let me give you three quick points on that. So the point is, we're to be motivated by truth and reality, not by reputation or our environment. Are you motivated by reputation and environment, or truth and reality? So let's imagine this. You're praying in a prayer group, and you pray these words: "Oh God, I am such a bad person. I am such a sinner." That's okay, right? But what if the person next to you says, "Amen"? What happens inside of you at that point? You just recalibrated, right? So what happened? If somebody would do that to me, I'd figure, what's with you? Like, it's true that I pray it, and I pray it to God, but if you agree with me, it somehow sharpens in a way that I don't appreciate. But if you meant it, truly meant it, yeah, it's true. Thanks for being here with me. If you meant it, you can do that. But if you get that reaction, then it wasn't quite true, right? Okay, that's the point here, and I'll give you another one. So there's a parable from, somebody just made up this parable, but take it for what it's worth. Peter and John were walking with Jesus, and Jesus asked them to pick up a rock. So Peter picks up a normal-sized rock, and they walk with it for a few miles, and John has this big thing, and he's, I don't know what's going on, but they're walking, and Peter's, and John is walking with his rock. And after about 3 or 4 miles, John is hot and bothered, and Peter's okay. So they sit down by a stream, and then Jesus turns the stones into bread, and they have lunch. So Peter has bread, and John has bread. And then the next day, Jesus says, "Okay, you two, can you pick up rocks?" So what happens? Peter, being Peter, picks up rock. Okay. And then John takes his normal rock, maybe something like that. And they walk. And after maybe 2 hours, they stop, and they put them down, and they put them down. The end. And then Peter's bothered. "What's this? I thought I was bringing supper," kind of thing. He didn't say it, but what? And then Jesus simply asked this: "For whom were you carrying the stone?" Right? Were you carrying it for Peter? Were you carrying it for me? I asked you to carry it yesterday. You were carrying it for who? Carrying it for me or for you? And today, who are you carrying it for? Obviously, Peter was carrying it for himself. But Jesus has that way of simply clarifying. If you think of the old style radios where they were just off station sometimes, where you had to literally dial it across, and they were off station, and you turn it a little bit so it's clear. So that's what Jesus has a brilliant way of doing. And this illustration here, when Peter says, "Who are you carrying the stone for?" It just has a way of clarifying. And then obviously Peter sees, it was for me. You told me to do it. I thought it was for you. It was obviously for me. So in those two situations, Jesus has a way of sharpening and bringing truth to a situation. I love that about him, that he's able to do that. He sees things so clearly and is able to say it so clearly. So the third one I want to look at is Peter's denial. In all four Gospels, Peter denies the Lord. 3 times it was prophesied. Jesus told him he would. Peter said, "I will never do it." Peter did it. But in one of them, I think it's Mark, it says the master looked at Peter. Oh, and all the other ones, it says Peter remembered when the cock crowed, Peter went out and wept. All four of them have that, but one has an added thing in there. It says the master looked at him, and Jesus came to him, or Peter came to himself, went out and wept. So if you think of how Jesus would have looked at him, not in judgment, but just in absolute truth, "Peter, I know this. This is what it's about." And Peter came to himself and saw truth and went out and wept. "What did I do?" And Jesus has that fantastic way of just bringing truth to a situation. So we can look around us and we can see the wrong things. It's very, very easy to do, especially with a crafty enemy that has thousands of years of practice. We can look around us and see the wrong things. We can focus on the important things and miss the critical ones. That is, I'm not sure how else to say that. We can focus on the important things and miss the critical ones. So Monopoly was important. The critical one was that one. And it's so easy to do that. And how do you see what God values? Is the question for us here. How do you see what God values? Just to touch on a few of them. How do you see what God values? When God specifically says this has tremendous value, focus on that. One of them being children. Think of your place in your life and how you're in action with children. Probably as a parent, How do you see what God values? Children is one of them. Put it here and look at it. His church is another. We can see church as one thing. How God sees church is another. Your spiritual well-being on the inside, preparing for eternity, those are things that God values tremendously. And how do we see them? Are we a monopoly or are we in the real world? And it's so easy to be on the wrong side. But we need to allow Jesus to bring truth to that and sharpen it exactly how he wants it to. And if the pinprick is extremely uncomfortable, that just means we need it. Wake up. It's like, wake up. You're just covering your eyes. You're not in reality. Tap, tap on the head. I can see you. Let him do that. So the more we allow ourselves to be taught of him and actually listen, because he gives straight answers to those that want them, including your heart and my heart. But we must be willing to walk in truth. So in 1 Samuel, when David was chosen to be king, they brought his brothers before him, and Samuel looked and couldn't find the one. Then God says, you look at the outward. God says, I look at the heart. And that's terrifying sometimes in a way, maybe, but it's also comforting in other ways. So depending how you view that, meaning simply, God sees what's there. God sees your heart, what's there. Let me give you a few stories here. A few years ago, Target, with their marketing program and their research, they had, Target has cards, I believe, maybe. So they figured out from their shopping habits, Target USA store, they figured out from their shopping habits, when people buy this, this, and this, and this, and this frequency, they are expecting a baby. So we're not talking diapers. We're talking organic stuff. Just certain things that ladies would start buying when they were expecting. So again, not diapers, not car seats, just normal generic stuff way ahead. So Target figured out, this leads to that. Eventually there's a car seat and so on and so on. But this stuff here goes there. So Target mailed out a, hey, glad you're expecting. Welcome to this new world, to this lady. And they got an absolutely furious, upset, irate dad calling that Target would send his 15-year-old daughter this stuff. What? He was absolutely incensed. And Target apologized and backtracked, and whoops, it went wrong. But it turns out she actually was expecting, and dad didn't know it. So think of this. This actually happened. Target Corporation knew ahead of his dad that the girl was expecting a baby. Is that odd? So how does a company like that figure stuff out that dad doesn't know? Moving again, Google. Google builds profiles of everything that you've looked at, everything you do, every news story, everything. Google has a picture of you that when people have access to it and look at it, it is extremely, in some cases, uncomfortable of how well they know you. You look at this and this story with this and this leanings. You're into politics, but this kind and this and this and this. And you check on this time of day and so on. They have a very detailed list of who you are, things that they put together. This and this means that, and so means this, which equals that. And it's in most cases dead on. More honest than people actually are with themselves, oddly enough. People look at it and saying, on the outside, I'm not sure about this, but inside they know that that's me. That's like a mirror. So Google has that about you. They know you better than you probably would admit to yourself. So flip again, and I believe at the end of time, when all things are known, and I don't know if God will show the world or everybody or just you or just him or how that would work, but I think all things come out in the end, good and bad, that what you think, who you are, what you did, how you felt about cleaning the bathroom, hatred in your heart towards a brother, forgiveness when it was a tremendously hard thing to do, those things are recorded. We'll read at the end in the close here about the Lamb's Book of Life. What's all in there? I don't know. Maybe it's just a name. Maybe it's a detailed record. But look at it this way. God sees everything clearly, sharply, true, crystal clear clarity. What you think, what you look at, what's on your phone, everything is just open to him. God looks at the heart, what's there. He sees like a kitchen table with keys on it, a phone, a fork, a frog on the kitchen table. It's just laid out. You can see it. There's no covering it. It just is there. That's how God sees things. So are we covering our eyes with these things? As far as dealing with ourselves, are we able to walk in truth and let God work with us in such a way that it's clear and true our life? So if we apply truth, not reputation, not what people think, but what is, that's what God sees. So if that's scary for us, then the first step is to simply go to God in truth and work with those things, saying, yes, this is so, yes, this is so, yes, this is so. Step one, honesty. So I'm not going to go there. This isn't about keeping a clear conscience, not quite where I was going, but it fits absolutely in this. Jesus will absolutely deal with us according to clarity about who we are on the inside. But on the other hand, that's very comforting. And I'll give this illustration that's also a little bit light, but the point is this. There was a preacher that had a tremendous effect, and analogy, of course. So when he went to heaven, he went up the lane, and he was shown a house, and it was a grand thing, and it's like, well, okay, I worked for that thing. And then the angel who said, whoop, sorry, that's not yours. Yours is here. And it was a small one, just a normal little house. Nice, but normal. And then he said, what's that? And she said, the angel then said, no, that's the lady who prayed for you. So things are just put in proper context. So without those prayers of that lady and the mansion that she earned by praying for you out in public, and you got all this grandness and there was a fair bit of pride mixed in and you were a big man, you had a reward. So here's your house, and that one is for her. Nobody ever knew about her, and she prayed thousands into the kingdom. Through you, yes, but that was her work. And God has a way of just setting things how they should be. And I believe that's how it's going to be. So be concerned with how it is, not how it looks. And if you think of, I want to read this. This has always blessed me. When Joseph was tempted in Genesis, I'm done in a few minutes, so sorry if I'm going over time. So in Genesis, when Joseph was tempted, let me go back there. Just read one verse. I thought I had the reference. Okay, so the Potiphar's wife wanted to be with him in a way that was not good, and he said to her, there is none greater in this house than I. Neither hath he, your husband, kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. I have access to everything but you. How can I do this great wickedness and sin against your husband? No, he said, against God. Being by himself, alone in a country, far away, nobody knew it, nobody would have found out, had she not wanted it to be found out. They were alone in the house, it says, there are no other men there. But his perspective in his life as he walked through it was truth on the inside. And this is his answer. This is my place in life. I have access to everything but you. And if I go against this, I'm not sinning against your husband, how can then I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And that was his perspective. That was how he looked at it. And that was how he walked. That's why he's in here. I love that. So going back to Hebrews 11, if you think of those men, all of them did that. They allowed what God said to shape their viewpoint and walked in it, sometimes tremendously stubbornly, year for year for year for year. So live your life in such a way that light can shine where it will and there's no problem. Live your life in such a way that light can shine where it will and there is no covering or hiding. There's no problem. And God will set things straight anyways at some point. So my point isn't to just simply walk with a clear conscience. That's kind of what I'm saying, but not exactly. I'm saying walk in truth. Value what God values. Plan for what God plans for. Be wary of what God says to be wary for. Shun what God shuns and love what God loves. Don't be caught playing Monopoly. And I want to say this too, it's kind of an odd one, but a morally upright life can be off. How can I say that? A morally upright life can be off if it's not a Jesus life. So some of the situations we looked at, there were actually no huge moral problems in some things, but the viewpoint was just off, and it had, in some cases, catastrophic consequences. So your life, a morally upright life, could be off. If you're just going through the program, you could still miss it. You could be off station by a bit, and that's enough to have big, big consequences. So it needs to be Jesus-like. It needs to be, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and let him do that. So Jesus is the one that will call us back to reality or truth. think of this. If Jesus is taken out of the picture, when Jesus said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, and people try to scrub him out of planet Earth, what's that going to do to planet Earth? If you take the truth, Jesus, out, it's going to bring confusion, chaos, darkness, and deception everywhere, literally. But if you bring Jesus back and what he said and let him sharpen things just like he did with Pilate, here's the exact answer. And you allow it to pin it, that's just how it is. And you allow that in your heart. But what if he's neglected for us, for you, for me? What if Jesus is neglected? Truth is neglected. So you can live a Christian life according to the Bible and morals and the Old Testament, but you could actually miss truth in that because Jesus sharpens it. He'll take something that's close and just move it back to where it should be. So again, the statement of I'm a terrible person, it's a good statement, but if somebody next to you goes, uh-huh, there's something that needs to be recalibrated. And Jesus, in his spirit, he talks a lot. I was going to read that, but didn't get time. Jesus talks about the spirit of truth will guide you into all truth. If we let the spirit of God work into us in that way, align, shift, you're off here. So not a moral life, but a Christ-like true life. And Jesus is the one that will call us back to reality or truth. If we neglect Jesus, we neglect truth. We can be morally okay. We can go through a program, go to church. We can miss truth. That'd be a scary place to be at. He's the calibration. If we drift from him, we drift from reality and truth. In closing, I'd like to read Revelation 21, a few verses there, then we're done. Revelation 21, let's plan for this together. Revelation 21. I won't read all of it, but some. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. And he that sat upon the throne said, behold, I make all things new. And he said unto me, write, for these words are true, true, and faithful. And he said unto me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give unto him that is athirst of the fountain of water of life freely. He that overcometh shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But the fearful and unbelieving, and abominable, murderers, whoremongers, sorcerers, idolaters, all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. Skip to verse 22, because it describes the city with jewels and pearl and stuff. Going to verse 22, I saw no temple there for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb, or the temple of it. And the city hath no need of the sun, neither of the moon to shine in it. And the glory of God did lighten it, and the Lamb is the light thereof. And the nations of them which are saved shall walk in the light of it. And the kings of the earth do bring their glory and honor unto it. And the gates of it shall not be shut at all by day, for there shall be no night there. And they shall bring glory and honor of the nations into it. And there shall no wise enter anything that defileth, neither whatsoever maketh abomination or maketh a lie. Think of that wording there. In light of who Jesus Christ is, there is no lying there. There's no deception. There's no covering. There's nothing there that maketh a lie. I find that very beautiful. But they which are written in the Lamb's book of life. And again, just like Jesus tried to bring Pilate to the truth and clarity and the right way of viewing it, my challenge is to simply live a life that is a life of truth, upright, openness, in light of exactly what God reveals here. Like what he says here, now we look back and say, of course Jesus was right. At the time it didn't look like it. And there'll be a time when people look back and say, of course that's right, because we now see it, it's here. But maybe we're playing Monopoly and aren't quite cluing in when the real world is right there. And Jesus said it. Amen.